Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled 20th Century American Fiction, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Arnold Weinstein, the Edna and Richard Solomon Distinguished Professor at Brown University. Professor Weinstein received his undergraduate degree in Romance Languages from Princeton University. He received his master's and doctorate in comparative literature from Harvard University. Dr. Weinstein has been teaching courses on European, English, and American literature at Brown University since 1968. In 1995, he received Brown University's award as Best Teacher in the Humanities. Lecture 1, American Fiction and the Individualist Creed.
In giving a course on 20th century American fiction, one is faced with an immediate challenge that is probably something you can't really meet, which is what books would you put in and why would you use the ones you do. So I want to state at the outset that this is not a survey course, although we will be reading some of the major novels or fictions that have been produced in this country in this century. I wanted to choose books that would, in some sense, speak about us and all of our heterogeneity. Us today, as well as us at the beginning of the century. Us in terms of our beliefs, in terms of our values, our myths, as well as our facts. And in trying to determine what those myths were, I was led to think back on an experience I had, which is a bit anecdotal, but I think it will clarify for you what some of the governing assumptions of this course are. Namely, I was living in Sweden in the 1980s, and there was a rather fierce debate raging in the major newspapers, and it had to do with what the Swedes call jantelag, and in fact what it had to do with is the way a child in Sweden, but you could have substituted France or Britain or Germany or virtually any modern European democracy, the way that sort of child would be brought up in contrast to the way an American youngster would be brought up. And the point that was made, and I'm going to exaggerate it a little bit, but I think you'll see what I'm getting at, was that in Sweden, in this case, the child, almost from infancy on, is told about the reality of the group, of the collective, of the society, that this child is going to take his or her place within a larger framework, and that there will be a whole set of responsibilities that flow from that situation, but that there is also a sense of being incorporated within a group, and that one's own identity, in some sense, comes from that. And at its most extreme, the language went, therefore the child is told, don't make waves, you were part of the group, your own identity has to be subordinate, in some sense, to the reality and needs of the group. And that one, you can imagine the implications of this. This has to do with education, it has to do with one's horizons, it has to do with how one imagines one's life. The obvious contrast, of course, and this is what people were writing about in those days in the paper, is that the American child is probably told, if the child at least comes from a certain kind of background, that you have an infinite set of possibilities, you can be what you want, you can make your life into whatever is best for you, that you have choices, you have a kind of freedom, you are unique, you are special, you could be what you want. And it struck me then, and it strikes me now, that this is the most enduring, potent, fabulous American myth that we have. I think it underwrites our literature, but I also think it underwrites our lives. That for better or for worse, these are the issues that confront us about what it means to be an individual, what our horizons are, what kind of freedoms we've got. And I think when I say for better or for worse, we will actually see that many of the books we are going to read show us the worse as well as the better. A term that means a lot to me and that I'll be referring to in this course is a term you've all heard, which is freedom of speech. Now, we know that that term comes from the Constitution, and we know that it refers in its obvious sense to a freedom, a political freedom, an ability that is guaranteed us by law to be able to speak our mind, etc. I want to argue that freedom of speech is a concept that is very central to literary production as well. We're going to see that these books, which consist of language, are themselves about freedom. That is to say, the language that the author uses on the one hand, but the language that all of us use as word people, as word animals, that language has to do with freedom. That is to say, our language, our speech acts constitute for us a certain kind of maneuvering room, a certain kind of resource in dealing with the issues that surround us, in dealing with the deterministic forces that may coerce our lives. Our novels are particularly precious because they tell us something about this story of freedom, of making ourselves free, in some sense of using words to make ourselves free. The central player in this drama of freedom is obviously the individual, that is the belief that underwrites our private and our public gestures. And it's a belief, I think, that defines our image in the world. It's why people for centuries have come to this country. But I think as well it defines our own agendas individually. I'd like to spend the first three lectures looking at some of the origins of this belief in individualism and trying to articulate and trace the connections between, let's say, a number of major 19th century writers and texts who deal with this theme and the materials that we're going to be looking at in our course. And the term I'll use is the atomic self, a self that seems to be absolutely free, unencumbered. Where does this come from? What are some of its most important examples or exemplars? And I'll turn to figures at first who were most recognizable, some of the more titanic figures in 19th century American literature, just to kind of spell out for you the dimensions of this empowered self, this individual that is almost godlike, almost deified. And I'll begin with the most godlike and deified self that I know of, and that's Walt Whitman. And I'll simply cite some of Whitman's lines to give you the flavor of this really very impressive sort of religious item and article. Walt Whitman, a cosmos of Manhattan, the sun, turbulent, fleshy, sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding, no sentimentalist, no stander above men and women, or apart from them, no more modest than immodest. Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams. There is Whitman, I think, telling us what the subject of his poetry is going to be. And, of course, the capaciousness of the Whitman self is that this individual takes the measure of the entire country. All people will be included. Moreover, that last line I cited, unscrew the doors themselves from their jams. It's like we're going to open up the self. We're going to see this flow of power and energy that goes through the self. We're going to bring into expression things that have never been said before about this new figure. So Whitman is, I think, a key example here. Whitman, as one could cite Whitman for the rest of the course, who goes there hankering, gross, mystical, nude? How is it I extract strength from the beef I eat? What is a man, anyhow? What am I? What are you? Again, this insistent questioning, what is the measure of the world? It's the individual. It's the human being. It's no longer the gods. It's no longer the past. It's no longer the great figures of legend. It's no longer the kings and the queens. That's what other cultures have produced for admiration. Not here. This is a new creation. I contain multitudes, Whitman says. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. So Whitman would be one instance of this. Another instance would, of course, be Melville's Ahab, a figure, again, of titanic stature, a figure who typifies the empowered self. You may recall in Moby Dick, he's chastised by Starbuck. Ahab is, why are you pursuing this whale? This whale, this dumb creature, this creature produced by God. How can you possibly pursue it? And Ahab's answer is, all visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed, there some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike through the mask. If man will strike through the mask. The world is a kind of pasteboard punching bag, and the proper exercise of human initiative, human energy, is to strike through the mask. To me, the white whale is that wall shoved near me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me. He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. Here, then, again, is hubris, if you wish, because Melville is going to take the measure of this figure who goes right off the charts. But it is also this kind of, again, deified self, this sense of a kind of titanic individualism that I think is at the root of much of our own ideology. Well, those are two of the most conspicuous and famous examples. They come from earlier writers. They come from probably the earliest, most salient statement about these matters is de Tocqueville. The Frenchman who came to America in the 1830s wrote his very important book, Democracy in America, and essentially made the argument that a democratic culture, which is a new phenomenon at this point, will produce a new literature. And it will no longer deal with the gods, it will no longer even deal with nature, it will deal with man, with the individual. Moreover, de Tocqueville's thinking is particularly clear in the first great American philosophic writer of the 19th century, and that's Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson's essays, particularly an essay with a title which is so American, Self-Reliance, an unthinkable title, it seems to me, in a European text at the same moment. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist, Emerson writes. Just as Whitman said, do I contradict myself? I contain multitudes. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, Emerson writes. Don't bother to be consistent. Be true to yourself. Be true to your instincts. Be spontaneous. Insist on yourself. Never imitate, Emerson writes. Here, too, this abiding belief in the godlike nature of the soul, of the individual self. Emerson, of course, is paired with the equally great writer, his friend Thoreau. And there's probably no American book that is better known about the sanctity of the self, about the self as world, than Thoreau's Walden. To face life in its pith, to absolutely corner the elements of the world. This is the kind of thing that we see in Walden. I went to the woods, Thoreau writes, because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life. Here is the project of the self, to encounter the world, to encounter it in its pith, and to suck out its marrow, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world, or if it were sublime, to know it by experience. That project, moving away from society, moving to Walden Pond, living in close proximity, almost in a kind of antagonistic relationship, although it's loving too, but a kind of one-on-one with the natural world, that's not just Thoreau's project. It seems to me that that is a project that underwrites much of what we're going to be looking at in 20th century fiction as well. That is to say, an effort to reduce life to its essentials, for the self to feed upon the world, to bring it in, to suck its marrow, etc. A final instance from the 19th century that I'll cite is, of course, Twain's Huckleberry Finn. People living on a raft, one young man, one older man. Huck's line, "It's lovely to live on a raft. We had the sky up there, all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss whether they was made or only just happened." Or the final line in Huckleberry Finn, a famous line in American literature, about leaving the civilized world, about going out, lighting out for the territory ahead of the rest. Huck, who refuses to remain in culture, who wants to constantly seek the frontier, light out for the territory ahead of the rest. Well, I'm not going to claim that in the 20th century novel or in our own lives that we live on rafts or that we pursue white whales. But I do want to say that this effort to get clear of constraint, culture, civilized order, to coerce nature in order to bring the self to its plenitude and to its fulfillment, these are central issues, it seems to me, in American thinking and certainly in American writing. We'll see it in Hemingway's Nick Adams stories, but one sees it as well in a text like Farewell to Arms of Hemingway, about a doomed love affair, a couple caught in a war that they did not make. Or you'll see it in the desperate reprieve from history that is sought in Faulkner's Light in August, or even in the never, never world of Tralfamador in Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. These are all efforts that I think can be traced back to Walden of getting finally clear of civilization, social constraint, social necessity, conformity, and being free. This is that impetus towards freedom that is the very pulse of American thinking. And this notion of the empowered self is a myth that will not die. It's a myth that will not die, even though we learn over and over and more what a myth it is, how impossible it is for the self to be fully empowered, fully autonomous, deified, and godlike. But if you think once again about the American dream, about being free, for example, of one's origins, being free from the accidents of birth, free perhaps in some sense from the markings of race or class or gender, free to make one's way in the world, not to be constrained, we are talking about the same myth. And these texts are going to show us this. Now, in choosing materials for this course, I wanted to present the great classical texts of American modernism, that marvelous trio of Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and Faulkner, three dead white males perhaps, but nonetheless, three, I think, titanic writers in their own way. And I don't think a course on American fiction in the 20th century can dispose of these people, can do without them. I've also wanted to hold on to important but less acknowledged talents, people like Sherwood Anderson and Flannery O'Connor, whose work has a more bucolic dimension, a more rural dimension, but also has, I think, a kind of small-town poetry as well. And when I came to the mid-century and the more recent years, I elected to put together a mix of the known and the unknown. The known would be, for example, the wild and obscene William Burroughs of the Beat Generation, or the wacky, experimental, but down-home writer Kurt Vonnegut. And then the unknown, writers whose work may or may not be familiar to the people who take this course or look at these lectures. Robert Coover, for example, the genial, bawdy, postmodernist circus performer, or Toni Morrison, who is, I think, our most recognized and distinguished Nobel laureate writer, contemporary author today. and closing with Don DeLillo, conceivably the most unusual prose writer that we have, unusual in the sense that he shows us an America, an American world, a modern world, that we all know that we live in, but that we really haven't gotten around to looking at. All of these writers carry on with the grand themes that I've tried to outline. That is to say, the desire for freedom, for getting clear of culture, for somehow bursting free, finding a space of freedom, a space outside the social order, a concern with the hegemony of self, and also an issue that I'd like now to speak about, the effort to make a world, through art, through language. Freedom of speech, again. There's an old tradition, it's not so much in favor now. It was much talked about for years about defining the American novel, in particular the 19th century novel, but the American novel in general. And the terms that were used are that the American novel should be thought of as a romance and not a novel. And here the distinction was made between what we see in Europe and in England in the 19th century and what we see in America. You couldn't have Huckleberry Finn or Moby Dick in Europe. You could not have created those books in Europe. Walt Whitman is an unthinkable figure in Europe. That novel, for the most part, means a kind of narrative that is bent on social notation, in which you see social manners, in which you see class structure, you see social conditions, particularly after Napoleon. This becomes the great ambition of European narrative, to write about complex class relations, of social hierarchies, and to show the ways in which these social or ideological arrangements imbue human character, in some sense make up the very stuff of human relations, areas where we would think people are relatively free. In the European novel, we see instead the way in which all aspects of life, private as well as public, are colored by these social, political, ideological arrangements. Human longing frequently comes to be shown as impossible. You think of a great book like Flaubert's Madame Bovary. The novel, then, is informative and educational in that sense that it paints a picture of a historical moment of a particular set of social givens. Well, what's the romance? The romance is a very different kettle of fish. The romance would be a kind of fabulous tale about moral or spiritual or religious or metaphysical forces. It might be men on a boat seeking a white whale. It would have to do with individual projects that are symbolic. It will not have to do with the portrayal of the social order in the same way. You won't be able to mistake the American novel for history, for just a picture of historical conditions. It's not social notations. It's not the same familiar landscape that we know about in the newspapers and the history books. Now, as I say, this view of the American novel as romance is a bit discredited today. We are in a very powerful sort of ideological moment now. And I think, rightly speaking, people understand that even these so-called romances have their own ideological underpinnings. They, too, are a form of history if we knew how to read them. Still, I want to argue that the American dream and the American way of looking at things will not accept the view that life is 100% coerced and conditioned by social forces, by determinist forces. And so the American novel will not be content to denote or describe the social scene. It insists, as I've said, on freedom, on mobility, on desire, on speech. One of its central items is innocence. If you think, for example, of the work of Henry James, James's characters come to appear to us as people, American innocents who happen to have money usually, who then go to Europe to inherit the world. This is true from the early novel, The American. This is true, obviously, for Isabel Archer in Portrait of a Lady. But it's also the story that James tells again in his late novels, Lambert Strether's Education in the Ambassadors, Millie Thiel's experience in Wings of the Dove. It becomes an increasingly complex and dark fable for James. But Fitzgerald's Dick Diver can be thought of in the same way, as a kind of an American innocent, a brilliant young man with degrees from Yale and Johns Hopkins, who sets out to be the greatest psychologist or psychiatrist that the world has ever seen, to outdo Freud. And Fitzgerald is going to chronicle his fall. Freedom, innocence, freedom of speech. I keep emphasizing this term. We will see it in Sherwood Anderson's characters like Joe Welling, who uses speech in order to score victories against people who are more powerful than he is. Uses it the way all of us use it. I'm using it right at this moment. But we are verbal creatures. Our successes, our promotions, our recognitions don't often come with how big our muscles are, and not even with how much money we've got, and not even always with how smart we are. They often have to do with how articulate we are, how persuasive we are, how we enlist language in our relationships, how we use language to meet challenges. That's what Anderson's character Welling does, or we'll see in Hurston's character Janie Crawford in Their Eyes Were Watching God, the story of a woman who starts out as not exactly mute, but downtrodden, abused, and who gradually makes her way toward language and her own story. This becomes an emblematic pilgrimage of a woman's education and of a woman's liberation. We'll also see this freedom of language, freedom by language, in some of the more desperate texts of this course. I'm thinking here of Faulkner's book, Light in August, where his own writerly language is going to be called upon to somehow craft, suggest an exit from the various prison houses that his novel depicts. Prison houses having to do with misogyny, with racism, with a kind of death-dealing Calvinism. And Faulkner will not duck that story. He'll tell you that story. He'll make it painfully, almost unbearably present to you in his novel. Nonetheless, he will be seeking a way to somehow transcend those givens, to imagine, if not to actualize, some alternative world in which spirit would have its own place and in which love could somehow replace hate. These are all, again, examples of the way it is that the writer uses language, uses his own medium, just as we do, to find a reprieve, to get clear, to make another space. We'll see this in some of the experimental work towards the end of the course, Robert Coover's astonishing verbal liberties with the actual political record of Richard Nixon and the Rosenbergs who were executed. We will see what Coover is able to do with this factual material, this ballast of material that is as much ballast as the cetology and whale data is for Melville. And in both cases, we have fictions, Melville's as well as Coover's, that reach for the metaphysical while always acknowledging the physical and the historical. Even when we get to a character like Sulla, Morrison Sulla, we're going to see this same pursuit of freedom, a freedom that is bracing, that takes on from where Janie Crawford in Hurston's book leaves off. Sulla goes still further. I think it's a blood-curdling book, a brief, elegant book that nonetheless raises very, very tough questions, a kind of self-assertion of a black woman character that borders on the monstrous, a kind of celebration of self in that text, at the expense of everything else. It's as if Morrison were experimentally looking at these issues. How free could you be? It's one thing to become free. It's another thing to keep going. What would the itinerary of liberation actually look like? Could a black woman writer create the same kind of self as cosmos that Whitman spoke of? I am a cosmos, Whitman said. Sulla, too, is a cosmos. So these projects of realizing, liberating, actualizing the indwelling powers, often the divine powers of the self, of freeing the self from the constraints that would keep it down, that would make it conform, that would somehow imprison it. These are the projects of American life and of American literature. And they bear witness to a kind of indomitable desire for freedom. I think that's our American signature. A kind of free enterprise that creates a dazzling world of its own. A kind of writerly wonderland, in some cases, a kind of personal universe, self as cosmos. At the same time, because literature is always environmental, no matter how much it centralizes a self, these fictions over and over are going to reveal our caughtness, our in-the-world situation. They will show that even the self that seeks to be divine and absolute and a cosmos belongs to a family, a society, a culture, a race, a body. And so they will suggest, as well as the grand powers of self-liberation, the caughtness of living in the world, our astonished awareness that we do have neighbors, that we inhabit an ecosystem, and that self will not take the measure of the world. Thank you.